evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the 52nd episode of Hitler's Table Talk. I am Carolyn Yeager, and
I'm Ray Goodwin.
It is March 26, 2015. Tonight's program is, to my mind, and I'd already told you this, Lee, maybe the best that we've had all along. I just think it's so very interesting and tells us so much about Hitler, subjects that I'm particularly interested in. And another thing has been this plane crash has got me caught up in that and finding it was we were kind of expecting something strange for the reason that it happened, but boy, it's really strange, and I'm rather upset about that too, and I've been focused on it quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, plane crash in Germany.
Right.
You know what I'm talking about, I hope.
Yes, it's been in the news. I'll tell you what, Carolyn, you are. I can barely hear you. You're not near as clear and loud as you normally are. It's like, and I'm not saying this is what it is, but it's like you're about 3 feet away from your mic because
I'm. The same as it always has been.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, for some reason or other, through my phone here, it's a little bit weak. Okay. This would be lesson 52, as I call it, March 26th. Today, 2015, 29th of August, 1942, in the evening. Difficulties of the maintenance of organized society. My 20 Protestant bishops. Do we keep Belgium, France, and Norway? Universal suffrage signed the death warrant of the Austrian Empire. War with the partisans. We must adopt the arrogance of Britain. Education and stuffed heads. The safety valve of military service. Once we were a people of energy. A fitting job for a woman. There never was a party more badly led than the Social Democratic Party, and yet the masses flocked to join and support it. This, it might be argued, was because they had no alternative choice, but that's not true. Man is not endowed by nature with the herd instinct, and it is only by the most rigorous methods that he can be induced to join the herd. He has the same urge as the dog, the rabbit, and the hare to couple up with one another, being as a separate entity. The social state, as such, can be maintained only by a rule of iron. Take away the laws, and the fabric falls immediately to pieces. The easiest people to conquer are those endowed with the most versatility. The Swabians, for years on end, the only result of my rallies in Augsburg was ignominious failure. But once I had won them over, my difficulties were gone for good. In other districts, I had an immediate initial success, only to find that a week later I had to begin all over again. I had to fight desperately to gain power. But today there are only a few insignificant groups of intellectuals who remain obdurately against me. They are people bereft of logic, and their opinion is of no importance. Generally speaking, the people never question an established regime. They are content to accept things as they are. History affords three examples where those who have seized power have succeeded in winning over the people. The Roman Empire, the Holy Roman Empire, and the British Empire. In India, the British started by dividing the country. One portion consisted of crown colonies. The other was made up of independent princely states whose rulers became the vassals of the British crown. In the Eastern territories, our policy should be to encourage the survival of as many religious sects and communities as possible. If anyone should try to form them into one corporate entity, I shall have plenty to say to him. I should like each petty little district to have its own pope. Once only in my life have I been stupid enough to try to unite some 20 different sects under one head. And God, to whom be thanks, endowed my 20 Protestant bishops with such stupidity that I was saved from my own folly. If I had succeeded, I should now have two popes on my back and two blackmailers. I can easily deal with the 17 Protestant bishops who still exist, but it is only because I have the absolute power that I can do it. In this respect, the Holy Roman Empire had no success, and yet it survived as a power in the eyes of the world long after it had ceased, in fact, to exercise any power at all.
Hey, can we stop
principle
here for a minute, Ray? Ray?
Sure.
Are you hearing me okay?
Yeah.
Not too well, huh? Yeah, I wanted to ask some listeners if because I've got my CarolynJaeger.net email account open, and I wanted to ask some listeners if they could comment on whether they can hear me the same as usual or if they're not hearing me very well. So I'm going to check over there in a little bit. I know there's some listeners who are real good about responding, so I hope...
It's a good idea.
Because I just don't know what the problem would be. Since I'm on Skype, I thought we could talk about this little section just a little bit. But he is saying something here that goes against what most people say, Ray, and what we mostly take for as a truism. He says man is not endowed by nature with the herd instinct. Aren't we always saying that we all have the herd instinct and this is something that's used against us and so on? And yet he kind of likes the herd instinct. He's saying it makes it hard to run a state because people, you know, you have to have, if you don't have the laws there, nobody will follow, you will really follow along. They'll all go back to what they're doing. And he's saying that the human beings have the same urge to couple up with one other being, like a couple, you know, a couple, and do their own thing. What do you think of that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's very natural for individuals to look for a partner and then combine with that partner for a relationship, and that's the primary thing in your life. And that instinct comes before thinking of your people or your tribe as your actual family. I mean, that instinct may be there or that feeling may be there, but it is the individual relationship with another individual that you have chosen to be your partner as the primary instinct in your life. And I think that's what he means when he says man is not endowed by nature with the herd instinct. Maybe not by nature, but he comes to realize that, yes, it's definitely a part of me.
Yeah, I mean, do we think that he is right or is he wrong? I think in this particular evening, August 29th, he's really in top form. And he even goes a little too far at times where he's a little bit rash, I think, where he, you know, that happens sometimes when you're really feeling good and you really feel like saying things, and sometimes you go to a little bit of an extreme. Not much, but I'm going to point out a couple things. It also means that he's saying a lot of things in a really excellent way and not holding back. We're going to see some of that. Now, I think, what he's saying is that people will go into their family like the tribal thing, maybe. You know, end
yes.
up like the tribal thing. Instead of the state, which is he's always been the big supporter and promoter of the state and unifying.
Well,
unifying, you know, the people into a larger...
That's interest. Right. I thought, Carolyn, one of the most fascinating sentences of this section that we've covered so far is when he says the easiest people to conquer are those endowed with the most versatility. One would think it would be the other way around, but then you realize what he's talking about is the people that he is in combat with and the subjects and whatever, and as long as they're more diverse and have more difference of religious feelings or racial feelings or tribal feelings, they are the easiest to conquer, and that stands to reason when you apply it in that manner. And so that's why he said he would encourage all of these little units, wherever the German military was successful and they had conquered territory, all of those units within that territory, he would encourage them to, hey, have your own popes and do what you want to do. And the first time someone starts trying to organize them and say, hey, let's form a unity here, he said, I'm going to have a lot to say to that guy. And that makes sense. And taken in that light, I think that's what he's referring to.
Yeah, what you said, I agree with that. And he goes into that, that in the British don't try to get the people to think alike, and they don't try to get the people to... well, he says if you have a different religion, that's good. And anything
right.
like that is good. It's to keep people divided, really. And we know that whole thing, divide and conquer. That's basically what he's saying here. Is
sure.
He wants to conquer a people. That he would encourage anything that divides them into various factions, groups, and, you know, mostly you could call it factions. So, and what's so interesting here is that he's talking about these Protestant bishops, and he says, if I had succeeded, I should now have two, he was saved. He was saved from his own folly in trying to join these Protestant bishops together. And he's talking about the German Christian Church from 1935 or so, when he was backing that proposal and that plan. And so many people, Ray, who are fans of National Socialism and the Third Reich and are Christian and point to that idea of this German Christian Church and Hitler's wanting to get that going and his, therefore, his interest in Christianity. But he is now saying, which he did. He did want to do that then. But now he's saying that would have, once in my life have I been stupid enough to try to unite some 20 different sects under one head. And he's saying that all these bishops thought differently. And that he's thankful that he failed at it.
Right.
So I found that really interesting. I mean, that stood out to me right away. I'm not trying to. I like the idea of the German Christian Church myself. And when I read about it and see these symbols they had for it and so on, I think, oh, that's nice. You know, but, you know, he's changed his mind about some things. And I'm sure that that's what he's saying right here. Okay.
The only other thing I wanted to add about that was kind of goes back to what we were first talking about, and that's how you keep a conquered territory under control. And he uses, of course, he says in India, the British started by dividing the country. One portion of that country consisted of crown colonies, and that means colonies that are basically ruled by the British lord and master. Setting up institutions and whatever, but the other was made up of independent princely states where the Indian princes and all were allowed their own rule and everything, and the British were kind of a secondary authority there. And that was smart, very smart.
The vassals of the British. It wasn't.
Yes, right. Those rulers had to answer to the British, but to their people, they seemed to be the ones in command. And the actual rulers, because they were the ones up front and out among the populace. It wasn't the British. So, you know, that was a pretty smart thing to do. And that's why I said we've got to kind of imitate the British and their example.
Well, see, he wants his own people to be united. But
yes, sure.
Who he wants to... have them.
That's your main point, Carolyn. That's the exact point that he's driving at.
Is that they, you know, it's good to keep them divided.
That's right.
Makes sense, but it's just the fact that.
Sure. Okay, moving on. A principle which must never be forgotten is that a confederation of states can be maintained only by a continuation of the methods used to conquer them and bring them into confederation. Fundamentally speaking, Belgium, France, and Norway are not our natural enemies. I have no desire to incorporate all Frenchmen in the Reich. those who dwell on our borders and with whom we have contact are were all Germans 400 years ago. I admit, if I were to follow the example of the old Germany and ignore completely their origins and environment, then I should have to impose on them the will of the state without mercy or consideration. But the real question one must ask oneself is, can we absorb them with an advantage? Do they, by blood, belong to our own race? And then one must act in accordance with the answer one gives oneself. There is perhaps a fourth example, the Austrian Empire. What a mosaic, what an astonishing conglomeration it contained, and yet it held together. In a case like this, however, those in power signed their own death warrant when they introduced universal suffrage. Up to that moment, the German minority had held the power so securely in their own hands that no one has the right to say that minority government is a monopoly of the British genius. Then, however, there arose a general feeling that this state, in reality a German state, should not be allowed to continue for fear that it might lead to complete German domination and eventually to the foundation of a single pan-Germanic empire. The Hungarians, too, were most uneasy. Then came 1848. The Hungarians rebelled, but the rebellion was crushed with, most unfortunately, Russian assistance. Yet in spite of this, mention of the monarchy in Hungary arouses the deepest emotions to this very day, for the Hungarians still consider themselves to be the last survivors of the glorious epoch of imperial grandeur. With our 85 million Germans, we have in the Reich itself a major part of the population of the Germanic races. No other nation possesses so strong a proportion of these elements. It would then be a sorry business if, with such strength at our disposal, we failed to bring law and order to ancient Europe. We may have 100 years of struggle before us. If so, all the better. It'll prevent us from going to sleep. People sometimes say to me, "Be careful. You'll have 20 years of guerrilla warfare on your hands." I am delighted at the prospect. With a number of small armies, we can continue to dominate a large number of peoples. In the future, our divisions will not be in dull garrison towns like Lechfeld and Homburg, but will be sent to the Caucasus. Our lads have always shouted with joy at the prospect of service abroad, and I shall see to it that in the future they range the four corners of the world. Germany will remain in a state of perpetual alertness. We will adopt the British attitude of arrogance. In the time of the old German emperors, let it not be forgotten, the kings of England were of little more account than the king of Denmark today. In the first war, we found, on going through the pay books of prisoners of war, that many of them had served in the South African War. They had been all over the world, and for them, the fatherland was their regiment. With men like that, nothing is impossible. For the future, it will, I think, be essential to introduce a 3-year period of military service. Only by so doing can we ensure efficiency in the handling of new technical weapons. A 3-year period would be a great advantage to those who later propose to adopt a learned profession, for it will give them ample time to forget all the muck that was jammed into their heads at school. They will have time to discard everything which will not be of future use to them, and that in itself is most valuable. Everybody, for example, learns 2 or 3 foreign languages, which is a complete waste of time. The little one learns is not of the slightest use when one goes abroad. Everybody,
Ray, I agree.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I think we should have stopped at the beginning of this paragraph. And
okay.
I'm checking my email again. Yeah, here it comes. "You are hard to hear, Carolyn," Raymond says. And S.J. Lewis says, "It's very low, Carolyn. Ray sounds very good." Well, I don't know if turning up my mic is going to do anything. What does this do for you, Ray?
It's still of the same level.
Yeah, I don't think it's my mic. It's something else. That's really too bad. See, everything's going wrong with this show. Let me see. There was another one here. Maybe he says, he's talking about the herd instinct. Well, I'll just read what this Raymond says about the herd instinct, since I'm at it. Today, because of modern anthropologic and social research, he would say that white European man is not endowed by nature with the herd instinct. There are other non-white races, such as Jews and black Africans and their descendants, mixed and pure, who are endowed with the herd tribal instinct. Well, what do you think of that?
Well, you know, I mean, it's an interesting line of thought.
I think what he was saying, he meant white European man. I mean,
Yeah.
Okay, well, I don't know what to do about except to talk real loud. If I talk real loud, I was trying to teach myself not to talk loud. Do I sound louder when I do that? Do I sound loud or not?
I mean, right now you sound audible to me. It's not that it's fuzzed or unclear, Carolyn. It's just that it's low volume, and I have to really kind of concentrate on this end to hear some of the things that you say. I'm picking them up, but like I say, it's of a lower volume.
Yeah, well, here I am. When he talked about the Confederation of States, you can only maintain something like that by continuing the methods you use to conquer them and bring them into a confederation. That made me think of the Russian Federation. Germany was a confederation of states. And so that's what he's talking about. But anytime you have a confederation or a federation, you have to continue working to keep them together, to keep them from separating and splitting apart. But when he said, but the real question one must ask oneself is, can we absorb them with advantage? Do they by blood belong to our own race? And then one must act in accordance with the answer one gives oneself. I thought that's a great quote from him, because he's talking about people who live around the Reich. He's talking about people in Belgium, France, Norway, etc., saying they're not our enemies, but they all were Germans at one time, he likes to think, basically. But he's saying now, though, that do they fit into the Reich? And we have to ask the question, can they be absorbed to our advantage? Do they by blood belong to our own race? And so here he's focusing on the blood as being important, and he's talking about race again, using the word as not as it's used officially by people, but as he uses it, like close to being a nationality, or your German race, your French race, and your Norwegian race, British race, whatever, and using it in that way and talking about, are all these people of the Germanic race, and can we all fit together? Can we all, come together as being belonging together? Or that question has to be asked, which, again, to me emphasizes how particular he was and how much attention he paid to race and to who becomes a German and who doesn't become a German. He was not in the least open to anybody who wanted to become a German becoming one. And that's the place where I like to point out that ideas like VKC has, Veronica Clark has, are not the kind of ideas that Hitler has whatsoever. And she's got a lot of people saying, well, I think Hitler was real easygoing about this, and he even didn't have a problem with Negroes joining the German gene pool, things like that. Just absolute nonsense, And
right.
So I would like to point out when he is saying things that prove that he didn't think that. And the other thing.
Sure. Well, you're real close in the text to something that I was going to comment on. When he talks about the Austrian Empire, and he says, what a mosaic, an astonishing conglomeration. And he says those in power sign their own death warrant when they introduce universal suffrage. And, you know, I'm assuming that means everybody gets to decide who's going to be the leaders of this country and whatever, rather than keep this thing. I mean, that's like a national movement. It's not like a state or a provincial movement. And he says those that who are really keeping that conglomeration together as a unit are in danger if they allow that.
Well, I don't know. I didn't quite follow that, but I think well, the way I see this is that you know how he criticized the Austrian Empire as being a mixture of Germans and Slavs and some others, Hungarians too, and a lot of things. He disapproved of that, and I think that's what he means about universal suffrage. When they allowed everybody to vote, he's not talking about between women and men, he's talking about between these different, what he would call races, you know, he would call them races, that was a mistake. And that was also took place in the British Empire. Too great of an extent, according to him. I don't know exactly what part of the British Empire he has in mind. He may be thinking about, I don't know, but is that the way you took it?
Well, yeah. I mean, he keeps using the British success as his example, and there was one thing here.
What he's saying here is that the Austrian Empire was this great combination of different peoples, and it held together because the Germans were running it. But when they went to universal suffrage and so on, then that was the end of the greatness of that.
Right.
So again, he's very pro-German. He's just always so
pro-German. Oh, sure,
or
sure.
Say Germanic. You know, he'll include all Germanic peoples. And then, well, I thought somewhere he talked about Pan-Slavism, but that might be somebody else in another thing that I was reading. But
well, no, it was in there. Well, Pan-Germanic Empire was mentioned in our text here.
But somewhere I was thinking of something else about Pan-Slavism.
Okay.
But he also said, we have in the Reich itself a major part of the population of the Germanic races. So that's where you notice that he uses the plural form there. But he's using races here more clearly than anywhere else. It's not according to the standard meaning that we have for race.
That's right.
He uses the word race.
That's right. The S at the end of that word makes all the difference in the world.
Right, and so he calls it the Germanic races. I don't know exactly what he has in mind there, but in any event, he's always very sensitive and concerned about race.
Sure, and Nordics, Teutons, Celtics, whatever.
Right. That's it.
Yeah.
And then he's getting so expansive. Here's what I'd like to say about this. I hope people can hear me. This is a problem here. He's also saying that he's getting into, here's how I see this. He hoped that the war would be over soon, quickly, you know?
Sure.
He hoped to get it over very quickly. Now he sees it's not looking like it's going to be over quickly, or it might not be over quickly. So he's adjusting himself to having a long stretch of being at war and then seeing that as good, and you know, I've seen that in a positive light. Well, we'll always be alert. Of course, he's also saying that once we take over all this territory, we'll have to be very alert all the time with maintaining it, because he did bring up here in the beginning guerrilla warfare. You can always have people fighting against from these places. And he's saying, well, good. That'll keep us strong and alert, and we won't, we'll be able to handle it. That's what he's saying. I should cross out that first part I said.
Yeah.
And
he makes that point when he says, with a number of small armies, we can continue to dominate a large number of peoples.
And then he's and then he's talking about military service, and he wants to introduce 3-year military service. So he's seeing Germany more and more as a by necessity now, for what they're,
yes,
what they're going for now, by necessity, as a very militarily oriented nation, and how they're going to, you know, keep that going and keep what they need, keep all the troops and so on that they need. And this is why then he gets into education, because he thinks that,
yeah,
he doesn't want the youth to be educated just to be scholars and so on, but he wants them to be educated to be soldiers, really. So
that's true.
That. So this is all pretty controversial and changes a lot of the ideas that some people have had for a long time and just stick with about Hitler and what National Socialism was. And it's not that it's not that, but this war changed things in the fact that they didn't, you know, the decisions that he made, which I think he couldn't make any other decision, but move things in directions that were not quite seen in advance a few years back. So now the whole thing has changed. But what I see in Hitler is that he is elastic in this, and maybe too elastic. I don't, you know, but in that if when the situation changes and he sees he's not going to go back to the way it was, well, then he changes and takes a different view of things, so to speak, somewhat.
Well, I think that's very accurate, and I think it's all a matter of circumstance forcing this war, continuation of this war on him, and he's having to subvert his other goals he had for his country because of the military situation, and I think that he's saying, hey, you know, I can see that we need to introduce a 3-year period of military service because we can then ensure the efficiency in the handling of new technical weapons. And that's what they need right now, is men that are wise in that area rather than the ones who have gone to school and learned what he thought, and he comments on it and where we're going with this, with useless things that don't help the nation at all, don't help the individual at all. And it just shows that his priorities are shifting, and they are, that is a forced circumstance upon him that happened. He has to, his society has to become more military oriented. His people have to become that way, because he can see now that this thing is a matter of survival. This war is going to last a while. And so I think he's kind of changing to fit that need.
Yeah, that's very good. I agree with you, and I think that was important what you said about the more highly technical weapons and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they need to learn. So he's looking to a more professional army.
Right.
Absolutely, and that people remain soldiers for a career, you know, a lot of them. And then he's going to reward them later.
Correct.
With the little farms and so on in this new territory. So,
right.
All right, now he's talking about what's wrong with the schooling for the new kind of Germany that he's foreseeing. So I'm
right.
Sorry,
okay.
I stopped you right in the middle of that paragraph.
But that's all right. That's all right. We can pick it right up. I'll start with a little bit I've already said here. He said a 3-year period will be a great advantage to those who later propose to adopt a learned profession, for it will give them ample time to forget all the muck that was jammed into their heads at school. They will have time to discard everything which will not be of future use to them, and that in itself is most valuable. Everybody, for example, learns 2 or 3 foreign languages, which is a complete waste of time. The little one learns is not of the slightest use when one goes abroad. Everybody, I agree, should receive a basic education, but the whole method of instruction in secondary and higher schools is just so much nonsense. Instead of receiving a sound basic education, the student finds his head crammed with a mass of useless learning, and in the end is still ill-equipped to face life. Lucky are those who have the happy knack of being able to forget most of what they've been taught. Those who cannot forget are ripe to become professors, a race apart. And that's not intended as a compliment. In 1933, things were still being taught in the higher educational establishments, which had been proven by science to be false as long ago as 1899. The young man who wishes to keep abreast of the times, therefore, had to accept a double load on his unfortunate brain. In 100 years' time, the number of people wearing spectacles and the size of the human brain will both have increased considerably, but the people will be none the more intelligent. What they will look like with their enormous bulging heads, it is better not to try to imagine. They will probably be quite content with their own appearance, but if things continue in the manner predicted by the scientists, I think we can count ourselves lucky that we shall not live to see them.
Hey, Ray,
and I want to stop there. Yeah,
good. I do too, and I'm sorry, I'm going to preempt you there. I want to say that I checked on Skype and found that my microphone was turned down to practically off. And my microphone sound. Do I sound better now?
It's much better now.
Okay.
Yes, much.
It might be too loud now. Am I, you know?
No, not at all.
Well,
okay.
I'm not sure where I had it, but I don't think I had it as high as I have it now. I think I'm going to go back and move it down a little bit. But you know, I don't know how that happened, but Skype was trying to update for me, and I've been holding off on it, and somehow that thing got changed. And I haven't checked it. I used to check it all the time, but I don't think that much about it anymore, and I haven't checked it for a long time. So that was it. I'm glad I solved that.
Whatever. It's working fine now. You're sharp and clear. So, okay, I wanted to stop there because he makes this observation about, in the next 100 years, the number of people wearing spectacles and the size of the human brain will both have increased considerably. But the people will be none the more intelligent. And I think the reason he says that is because of his attitude about the education the people are receiving, and that is caused as a result of being taught what to think rather than how to think. And they've been programmed and propagandized and whatever, even in Germany at that time. And, and that's kind of what struck me there, too. On that level, and he felt like so many things that they were learning in school were actually useless to them. And there was a movement.
I was going to say that. This is one part where I think he's gotten carried away with himself when he starts saying that in 100 years we're going to have these big heads and. You know, and it's almost 100 years now, and we are not any different. We might be stupider, but I can't imagine. Maybe he was just joking, but that was the only thing I was going to say.
Yeah. Well, there was a movement in the American educational system. At one time, the American system of learning was set up based on what the ancients taught. Students were taught Latin, and some people will say, well, that sure was of no use, and your basic mathematics and things like this. And then a fellow like John Dewey came along and decided they need social instruction and we need to revamp everything. And it's two ways of looking at that. We studied a lot of that when I was working on my degrees. And what's your viewpoint on this? There were in my class. There were the professor wanted two points of view. He wanted someone defending the old school, and he wanted someone promoting the new. And the students decided I should represent defending the old way of educating, and then someone else was going to represent the new way of teaching students in American schools. And I guess I researched it and did pretty well, because when I got through with my side, the professor says, boy, that is right down the line from 1700s and 1800s American education in the schools, the basics and then now this youngster in there, to me was a youngster, then took off on why U.S. schools were so much better off with the curriculum they have now versus the very basic things that were taught 50 to 100 years ago. But that's kind of what I thought he was thinking about, you know, when he was talking about school is so invaluable, you're taught with so much stuff that clutters your brain, you don't need it, and that's kind of where my mind went when I was thinking about what he's saying here. And, you know, his talk about people are going to be wearing, got a lot more people going to wear glasses, big heads, because your brain's going to grow and everything. I mean, he might have been thinking that if this whole thing keeps going and keeps going the way it's going, which it didn't, of course, because the war changed a lot. But it was just him describing a situation.
Well, you know, he's a self-learner. And he didn't think that what he learned in school, and most people realize that. You learn outside of school probably more than you learn in
school.
That's
right.
And you're learning
exactly
all
right.
the time. And if they try to give you everything you need before you get out of school, it's just overkill. And then, you know, you're kind of, I don't know, maybe you're in worse shape than if you were just allowed to have a more balanced curriculum. And he's always wanted a lot of sports and outdoor activity. Not just because
sure.
he liked that when he was young, but, you know, knowing that that makes strong
well,
people, and that's the kind of Germany that he saw was a strong, healthy, tall people.
Exactly,
a
trade and a vocational type educational system was much more important and valuable than teaching algebra and French and things like this. And I kind of think that's where he was going with that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. He says, when I was a schoolboy, I did all I could to get out into the open air as much as possible. My school reports bear witness to that. In spite of this, I grew up into a reasonably intelligent young man. I developed along very normal lines, and I learned a lot of things of which my schoolfellows learned nothing. In short, our system of education is the exact opposite of that practiced in the gymnasia of ancient days. The Greek of the Golden Age sought a harmonious education. We succeed only in producing intellectual monsters. Without the introduction of conscription, we should have fallen into complete decadence, and it's thanks to this universal military service that the fatal process has been arrested. This, I regard, is one of the greatest events in history. When I recall my masters at school, I realize that half of them were abnormal. And the greater the distance from which I look back on them, the stronger is my conviction that I'm quite right. The primary task of education is to train the brain of the young. It is quite impossible to recognize the potential aspirations of a child of 10. In old days, teachers strove always to seek out each pupil's weak point, and by exposing and dwelling on it, they successfully killed the child's self-confidence. Had they, on the contrary, striven to find the direction in which each pupil's talents lay, and then concentrated on the development of those talents, they would have furthered education in its true sense. Instead, they sought mass production by means of endless generalizations. A child who could not solve a mathematical equation, they said, would do no good in life. It's a wonder that they did not prophesy that he would come to a bad and shameful end. What I see in that right there, Carolyn, is in my mind, it's like I've always thought of this, and very simple, basic thing. If you're hiking an unfamiliar country and you backpacked and all of a sudden you're lost, you have no idea where you are. You're facing danger. And you come up on two men, and one of them's an IQ of 165, is a nuclear physicist. And the other one might be toothless, chewing a wad of tobacco, but he knows how to live off the land. Which one of those guys are you going to pick to help get you out of that mess? It's going to be the guy that's illiterate and whatever, but he knows practicality. And I think that's exactly what Hitler was talking about here. Someone who learns practicality, living off the land, so to speak, versus book smarts. And to me, that's what the Fuhrer was stressing.
Yeah, well, I thought this was very excellent, and I underlined it. And I think what they did in the schools then is that they really did say that you could not continue in school if you didn't pass everything, if you weren't, you know, if you couldn't master everything, including mathematics, which a lot of people had trouble with, and things like that. And Hitler is saying that that's the wrong thing to do, and you kill the young person's self-esteem and feelings about himself, and that you, and it also prevented that student from getting into any higher or any from moving forward in life. You know, he was stuck at a certain level. He was stuck in as a worker type person, and he couldn't get into school. He couldn't go further in school.
Right.
No matter how talented
he
might be in certain areas, and you couldn't like him. But he experienced that he couldn't get into art school or architectural school because he didn't have these other schooling behind him, even though he had the talent and the ability to do so. And that's the way the system worked then. And a lot of people have talked about this, and he said that was a really bad system. And what he's initiated in, and he and others initiated in, into the Hitler Youth and National Socialist Education and so on, was that you look for, as he says here, you look for what the student is good at. And if they're not good at certain things, well, okay,
correct,
they don't go on to a higher level of, but they do go into schools that teach them, you know, help them with what they are good at and what they like. And you keep everybody moving forward that way. And you keep everybody productive and feeling good about being a part of the German nation, not feeling like they're a second. You know, it used to be before Hitler's time, and Hitler's told some of these stories, that it was so the nobility and the upper classes were so snobbish that they, well, we've talked about this too, Ray, that they actually disliked all these German lower class people and didn't want to even have anything to do with them, you know. But they liked people of their own class from other nations and all around Europe, and they hobnobbed those people. But their own German people, they thought were not worthy to be in their company, you know, to even participate in national events that were taking place. So Hitler thought this was so terrible, and that's one of the best things about him, amongst many good things about him.
That's exactly right. That's so true. And not only that, but, you know, he saw the waste of young students who had been typed and classified as, well, you can't work this mathematical problem, so, you know, you're not really going to be of much use to society. Not only was that so damaging and wasteful to the young student, it was depriving the nation of possibly some of its best leadership. Because these kids who may not have excelled in one area might have gone on to be, let's say, a really wonderful Gauleiter or whatever, but they were turned away at the very beginning of when they were trying to learn.
Participate, Ray, but they couldn't go on into a higher level of schooling, and that was everything.
Yeah.
If you didn't complete all the schooling, you were just, you know, you were typed then, you didn't seem to be able to move into higher paying positions and so on. So, but you had to know it. You had to, and these kids back in those days, they really sweated this out. You know, it was so important.
That's right.
We've read about this in more modern times. We've read about it in Asian schools. I can't think of it right now, but. Where the standards are so high and they have to work like crazy, you know, while they're at a certain age to pass all this and learn all this stuff in order to keep going, or they'll be stuck forever. So, and then he says, did you read this part? This questions would have defeated my own mother, or did you stop before that?
No, we're not to that yet.
Okay.
Very close.
All right.
Okay. Okay, he says, have things changed much today, I wonder? I'm not sure. And many of the things I see around me incline me to the opinion that they have not. I was shown a questionnaire drawn up by the Ministry of the Interior, which it was proposed to put to people whom it was deemed desirable to sterilize. at least three-quarters of the questions asked would have defeated my own good mother. One, I recall, was, why does a ship made of steel float in the water? If this system had been introduced before my birth, I'm pretty sure I should never have been born at all. Let us, for God's sake, throw open the windows and let the fresh air blow away nonsense of this nature. Put the young men into the army, whence they will return refreshed and cleansed of 8 years of scholastic slime. In the olden days, we were an energetic people, but gradually we developed into a people of poets and thinkers. Poets do not matter, for no one takes them seriously, but the world is greatly overburdened with thinkers. I keep a bust of Scharnhorst on my table. It is he who started our people back on the road to sanity. The world at large welcomed this Germany of poets and thinkers because it knew how they sapped our virility. One of the worst pupils of whom I have ever heard was little Fraulein Wagner, who was the bête noire of her teachers and who was finally expelled from school. While nursing at the front, she was seized with the desire to become a doctor. She returned to school, passed all her examinations easily, and is now studying at the Higher School of Medicine. This is a fine example of perseverance supported by enthusiasm. It is a mistake to say that youth is stupid. Youth follows its instinct, and any little urchin has a very much shrewder knowledge of his teacher than the latter has of him. My dog understands perfectly everything I say to him. I'm the one who does not understand. Still, we have made progress in the field of education in spite of having a pedant at the head of the educational department. With another in control, progress would have been more rapid. A man worthy of the name does not solemnly relearn the alphabet each year. With a woman, it's different. She's following the laws of nature and is fulfilling her natural function when, having had a child, she starts to have another. But there is no professor who, to my knowledge, has shown creative genius. Yes, Felix Don, but then he was no real professor. A man who spends 30 years teaching the rudiments of the French language comes in the end to believe that his instruction is the foundation of all knowledge. Just think how in the old days a bit of paper could alter the course of one's whole life. Look at my school reports. I got bad marks in German. My disgusting teacher had succeeded in giving me an intense dislike for my mother tongue. He asserted that I would never be capable of writing a decent letter. If this blundering little twerp had given me a grade 5, I should have been precluded from becoming a technician. Now, thank God, we have the Hitler Youth, where the child is judged on all his qualities and not solely on his scholastic attainments. Character is taken into consideration. The talent of leadership is encouraged, and every child has the legal right to show what he can do.
Yeah, that's like the Hitler Creed I wrote down. That's mm-hmm. that's something that he says, and he really believes it, and it's a strong decision in him that this is the way things should be done, and this is the way the Hitler Youth is going, and it's excellent, I think, just excellent.
Oh, I do too.
Yeah.
That last part summed up the first lengthy section of this part, exactly what he was talking about.
Right. I get ahead of myself and thinking of things that are coming up ahead, but you know, here I want to bring up where I was saying, I think sometimes he goes too far, and he's doing it again in this paragraph before the last one with women and differences between women and men. And, you know, he always compares them to the detriment of women. In some cases, I can certainly understand it, but to say, I have to pick on him here, to say that a woman having one child and then having another child is not the same as learning the alphabet over and over again. You know, that's what he's trying to compare, that women can do the same thing over and over again, and when men would just not ever do the same thing over and over again, which is not really the case. And certainly having more children is not doing the same thing over and over again. It's like teaching children every year the rudiments, the ABCs and so on.
That's an interesting perspective, you know, and that's good. I hadn't even thought of it that way, Carolyn. When I read that, to me, if I may offer this, how it struck me was when he says, a man worthy of the name does not solemnly relearn the alphabet every year. He meant to say that, hey, once the man has studied that, he's got it down, he doesn't forget it. And then when the woman comes along and has her child, it's the same thing. She has that first baby, then she steps right in, and she doesn't have to learn all over again about what childbirth is about and everything, because she's much better at it. She learns it, knows what it is the second time around, better than the first time, and that's how
it's
going to
be. Well, but he says here, with a woman, it is different. So he's saying that the woman is different, not the same.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, well, she's, as he also says, she's following the laws of nature. And when he's talking about the man, he's talking about the educational system and learning that alphabet every year. But at any rate, it was an interesting perspective and a good point.
Well, he's comparing them. You know, it's the thing about the dog. It's so true that that dogs understand what we're saying, what we want, but we don't understand what they do.
He said, I'm
but
the one that
sometimes
doesn't understand.
We do. Yeah. So he was aware of that. I like this story. I like when he said that this girl who, and you know, a bête noire is someone who everybody dislikes. Nobody liked this Fraulein Wagner, and they even expelled her from school. They just thought something they didn't like about her. Anyway,
right,
she went to the front and nursed, and then she was seized by a great desire, you know, to become a doctor, and she goes back to school, passes everything, and is a doctor now. And so he says, a fine example of perseverance supported by enthusiasm. That's so right on. That's exactly what are the most important qualities probably for getting somewhere and success. And he's picked the words just exactly right. In most cases, he's so exact with the truth. He understands things so perfectly well. And I just wanted to mention that Scharnhorst was a general. He died around 1850-something, but he was one of the great generals. He was in the service of the Prussians, and he was noted for his military theories. Of course, he's very famous in Germany. When Hitler kind of puts down, he's not moved by the idea that Germany is the land of poets and thinkers. And that's what's been said. I thought this was really interesting because that's what's been said all the time. And in fact, they say how could the land of poets and thinkers be taken in by someone like Hitler and his henchmen, you know, and this just doesn't fit. And that's what the Jews like to keep promoting, that idea all the time too.
Correct.
That this is what Germany is, and Hitler is actually saying, I don't want to be just the land of poets and thinkers. We want to be a land of doers and conquerors and so on, and strong people. And I think this is quite an interesting look at what he's thinking about. Because this has always been, you know, like, oh, Germany should be proud of its poets and thinkers, but he didn't want to just be that.
That's right.
So, yeah.
All right, shall we move on to 30th of August, 1942 in the evening?
Yep, and I have a timeline here.
Oh, good.
It's the Battle of Alam Halfa in Egypt, a few miles south of El Alamein. Alamein. Is that pronounced El Alamein?
Alamein,
El Alamein,
yes.
That's how I hear it. Begins. This battle begins. It will be Rommel's last attempt to break through the British lines. The RAF air superiority plays a large role, it says. And also on the 30th, Luxembourg is formally annexed to the German Reich. Just like Austria was, I guess, that way, became part of the German Reich. So it must not have been called Luxembourg anymore, at the moment anyway, as far as I know. But people would have still been calling it that. But.
Yeah. Okay. Brigands of yesterday and today, the Russians and prostitution, unseasonable weather. After the 30 Years' War, brigandage flourished for many decades, and the post had to be escorted by a squadron of cavalry. It is here in Russia that communism shows its true face. We must undertake a campaign of cleaning up square meter by square meter, and this will compel us to have recourse to summary justice. The struggle with the territories will be savage warfare in the real sense. In Estonia and Latvia, these bands have all but ceased to be active, but until Jewry, which is the bandits' intelligence service, is exterminated, we shall not have accomplished our task. It's interesting to note the way in which this little Catholic priest, who calls himself, is that Tiso or Tiso, Carolyn, T-I-S-O? Tiso?
Well, I think it's Tiso.
Yeah, that's the way I would call it. Mm-hmm. A priest who calls himself Tiso sends the Jews into our hands. Fundamentally, there is a certain moral to be drawn from the Russian attitude towards brothels. It is beneath one's dignity to legislate for such places. In our own country, however, prostitution has to a certain extent been sanctified by the fact that it was the archbishops and the bishops who introduced the levying of the harlot's tithe. The princely bishop of Mainz drew a large portion of his revenues from this source. That the Bolsheviks admit the legality of a woman's having children by different men is due, I think, to their desire to bring about a fusion of their various races. It is curious, but it is nonetheless a fact, that our medical examination show that 80 to 90% of their unmarried girls up to the age of 25 are virgins and have a clean bill of health. The continuation, week after week, of fine weather.
Well, before we go on to the weather, let me just comment on this. We're kind of breaking
Good.
This up
okay.
a lot, but, you know, it's this thing about the Bolsheviks and the prostitution, and then he's talking about, he kind of jumps.
Yes, the archbishops.
He jumps from saying that Bolshevism, women can have children by different men, and we know that was very loose under communism. These kind of traditional roles were not played up in the same way. And he said they desire to bring about a fusion of their various races, meaning all those various races in Russia. But then he goes into something altogether different. And is he talking about the same people? I don't think so. He says our medical examinations show that 80 to 90% of the unmarried girls up to 25 are virgins and have a clean bill of health. Well, what he's saying here, he's going back to what he said maybe it was only a few days ago or a day or two ago, but it was a few weeks ago for us.
Yeah.
Where remember when he was talking about the women from Ukraine, I thought it was, or he might have said the Slavic women, the girls that came, I don't know where they came, but I guess they came over to their side or whatever, and they were occupying that area, so they were part
right.
of what was
going on. It was
in
their military camps.
Yeah, and he said, gee, they were virgins, and then he was saying how the girls in Bavaria don't remain virgins, but these girls were young women were virgins. So I don't think he's kind of jumping from one thing to another here, and he's just going back, or he's thinking, he's remembered that fact, and so he's used it here, even though it doesn't exactly fit with what he was saying, if you ask me. And it might be the fault of Haim, the note taker, for all we know.
That's possible, but I just took a look at it from my own perspective as a general view of prostitution and the judgmental attitudes about it. And, you know, and he said the Bolshevik view or the Russian attitude toward brothels, it's beneath one's dignity to legislate for such places, making them legal or whatever. But then he turns and says, hey, it was our own archbishops and bishops who decided, boy, they're going to get a cut of this pie instead of condemning prostitution
yeah.
and trying to help the young ladies to another way of life. It was, hey, give me part of that money that you're making. And, the Bolsheviks, that the Bolsheviks admit the legality of a woman's having children by different men is due, I think, to their desire to bring about a fusion of the various races. Well, you're right, it does jump there, but
yeah.
it's the whole the whole thing about prostitution, you know, about how he's really condemning the archbishops and bishops decided, hey, let's put a tax on their earnings.
Yeah, that was interesting. Mm-hmm. I left that out. But, you know, I think maybe something might have been left out here. Because it doesn't make a whole lot of sense the way he's putting
it. It's very
this,
possible,
so.
Yeah. Okay, just to conclude this particular section, the continuation week after week of fine weather is most unusual for this district. Last year at this time, our advance in the south was painfully slow because every two or three days we had a thunderstorm. After the terrible winter of 1929, we had a series of fine harvests, and I hope we shall now have the same again. That we have succeeded in converting the Russian railway network to our own use is one of the most astonishing feats of all time. And that wraps up that little short section.
Yeah, well, I guess they've gotten Russian railway converted already.
Yeah,
well,
and that's pretty doggone
that's
good. What that meant was a different gauge of tracks.
Right.
The locomotives in Europe did not use as wide a track as the ones in the Soviet Union. And so all the tracks had to be widened, and that takes some doing.
And that's the organization that did that. That tote organization was invaluable, and everybody knew it. And it was too bad that Tote himself got killed in a crash. So many times these indispensable people get killed. It's just terrible.
Uh-huh.
Okay, for the timeline for the 31st is the start of a 1942 Luxembourgish general strike against conscription. So the Luxembourgers became part of the Reich, but then they didn't want to have conscription. What did they think? I don't know if they were forced to become part of the Reich. They are German people there, but they're actually mixed. There's in Luxembourg they speak French, German, and Luxembourgish. That's some kind of language, little language of their own, but it's not a real language because it's not even capitalized. It's just kind of a little dialect thing they have. So there are some differences, but they put up a big fuss over that, and I guess it was the police or the police had to come in, and they decided to get real tough with them because they couldn't go along with people saying they weren't going to go and serve in the war. So they really couldn't do that either. So they couldn't say, well, all right, we'll let you guys off. So they had to come down real hard, and they had to execute some people and so on. I don't really know how it all turned out, but it's kind of a big deal in history to these people, unfortunately.
Right. Okay, 31st of August, 1942, evening. Lloyd George and the Treaty of Versailles, the Error of Almeria, Britain, Germany, and the Duke of Windsor. Jews spur on the deadly work of the warmongers. Baldwin and Chamberlain. Churchill gathers a few crumbs. It is a mistake to think that all Britons are arrogant. It is perfectly true that they have a handful of degenerates at their head, and I must admit that our leaders of 1917 and 18 shone in comparison. I asked Lloyd George why it was that he had failed to gain his point when negotiations for the peace treaty were in progress. He was advocating a magnanimous peace treaty. He explained that Wilson opposed him from the beginning, and that the French never ceased from their witch hunt. It was not his fault, and he had done all that was in his power to do. When the German government declared that it would never sign such a treaty, the second draft was drawn up, whereby the Allies would renounce the corridor, we should keep the Cameroons, and the German Navy would be allowed to retain 4 battleships and 8 other major warships. The claim for reparations was also reduced to approximately 25 milliards. Lloyd George reminded me that at that time the British were hated by the French, and in Paris the old cry of Perfidi Albion once more gained currency. He also told me that he was surprised and completely taken aback when, at the last minute, the German delegation declared its readiness to sign. As they went out, Clemenceau hissed in his ear, voila. When a nation behaves too disgracefully, it loses all claim to respect. Neither Britain nor France would have been in a position to continue the war in 1919. But in the summer of 1919, the German people had already decided to continue the struggle. A wave of sympathy for Germany swept over Britain as a result of the bombardment of Almeria, and the Edent-Vansittart gang worked for years before they could suppress it. Recently, they have announced the internment of 11,000 fascist supporters of Mosley. The real reason for the destruction of the Duke of Windsor was, I'm sure, his speech at the old veterans rally in Berlin, at which he declared that it would be the task of his life to effect the reconciliation between Britain and Germany. That rally in Berlin bore the stamp of sincere and mutual esteem, and the subsequent treatment of the Duke of Windsor was an evil omen. To topple over so fine a pillar of strength was both wicked and foolish. The campaign of antagonism against Germany was organized by Churchill on the orders of his Jewish paymasters and with the collaboration of Eden, Vansittart, and Company. The Jews had already succeeded, step by step, in gaining complete control of the press. To counteract Rothermere, the Jews cut off his complete revenue from advertising, and it was Rothermere himself who told me the story of how he was compelled to toe the line. Any and every nation which fails to exterminate the Jews in its midst will sooner or later finish by being itself devoured by them. In retrospect, it is quite impossible to understand how all this happened. Old Baldwin started the rot. He himself had great interest in the arms industry, and rearmament certainly put many hundreds of millions into his pocket. Another with the same interest was Chamberlain. Churchill, the rattled old whore of journalism, picked up a few crumbs. Churchill is an unprincipled swine. A perusal of his memoirs proves it. In them, he strips himself naked before the public. God help a nation that accepts the leadership of a thing like that. Wow. Good stuff there, Carolyn.
Well, really, and you know, he really talks about the Jews there. Makes it very clear what he has against them and why, and I think that's really valuable.
I do, too. Yeah. And the thing that struck me was I wasn't aware that Lloyd George had been as magnanimous or tried to be as magnanimous as he could at the Versailles Conference, and he said everything he tried to do, Wilson cut him off. Wilson opposed him at every turn, and then he said, right. Of course, the French never ceased their witch hunt, because they were hateful and despiteful of the British at that point. And so, you know, I was pleased to learn that Lloyd George, because from what I'd studied of British history, and we had a lot of that in school in my degree work, but I came away with a rather favorable viewpoint of him simply because he seemed to conduct himself like a gentleman. And now I find out that, indeed, he tried to be magnanimous with the beaten enemy at Versailles and was just run over by Wilson, and yet it's Wilson in our textbook who is presented as the very magnanimous, gentlemanly, wanted to be kind over there, took his 14 points and was snubbed, things like this.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very nice thing to learn.
They never snubbed the Americans, you know, from a certain point on. The Americans were always had a very strong hand in all these things. But I like that he says right at the beginning that the problem with the Britons is they have a handful of degenerates at their head. Now, the Britons are okay, but the handful of degenerates at their head, that's really the true story about that country.
That's right.
And he
points out
some of the more recent ones. I think I had heard this story before, but hearing it, you know, seeing it again, it's really horrible. That, according to Lloyd George, that when the Germans, when the German delegation said they will never sign such a treaty, they started working on something that they would sign. They knew that it was too strict. And then
too
for
harsh.
Some
That's...
reason, too harsh, yeah. And then for some reason, right before they were going to present it, this German delegation turned around and signed it. Either they caved in or whatever happened to them. And then Clemenceau, who was, of course, the French prime minister who hated the Germans so much, was just so happy about that. That was, what do you think about that?
I think, boy, that was really something to learn, too. And like he says, Lloyd George says, he was completely shocked and taken aback when at the last minute the German delegation declared his readiness to sign, because his insinuation there, and I think he's exactly correct, if the Germans had said, to hell with this, we're not going to sign this revision either, you take it back and bring us something that we'll sign, they would have done it. And this,
well,
thus
they were doing it.
Yeah, I mean, the Allies would have had to revise some of those harsh reparations.
Maybe if they wouldn't have signed any of it, maybe if they wouldn't have signed until it was a whole lot better, they would have gotten away with that too. But see, Hitler would have stood up to all this. Hitler always stood up.
And
he learned from this, never to,
Well, right, and I think from that came Hitler's attitude of being stabbed in the back and sold out, that the German leaders dumped on the German nation by agreeing to all that crap at Versailles and signing that treaty when they didn't have to. In other words, they did. They could have held out for more. And when that became learned by people like him, it was just fuel to the fire to change things.
There was something. I can't think of it now. There was something that made them feel that they had to come to an agreement because they were starving or they were doing without. Something was going on.
Part of it. That's true.
Yeah. Have to go back, look at that again. Well, let's continue with this. He brings up the Eden Vansittart gang, and he mentions Vansittart a couple times in this as being one of those degenerate leaders of the elite that they have there. And then I was surprised that the British announced the internment of 11,000 fascist followers of Mosley. When did that happen, Ray?
Yeah. That one kind of surprised me, too. I knew that they had arrested people that dared to kind of speak out once the war had started, but I wasn't aware of any 11,000 followers of Mosley being arrested. That's the first I'd heard of it.
Okay,
so,
and then he says, then he's talking about the Duke of Windsor, saying how badly they treated him. But you know what I think about the Duke of Windsor? He was the heir to the throne, member of the royal family. He knew what his responsibilities were, and it seems to me he must not have cared that much about being king. He should have not married that woman and done what he needed to do for his country. And particularly if he wanted to lead it in a different direction. He was really serious about that. But I guess he was the kind of person who put a relationship ahead of everything, and they had such a fantastic love affair or something that he couldn't live without her, he says. So he gave that all up, and then his stupid, incompetent younger brother got to take the throne, and he didn't do anything good.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of disappointed in that Duke of Windsor. I think he had a weak streak in him. What do you say?
He was King Edward VIII, right? And he was the successor to the throne, but, you know, I think that he wanted peace with Germany. He looked upon Germany favorably.
Well, he did, sure.
The infrastructure all around him was harassing him because of that. And, he had this Simpson lady, a married gal from the United States that he was hot for and all this stuff, but I really don't think he sacrificed his rule for her. I think that he was driven out by the likes of the war gang, Vansittart, Churchill, Eden, and the rest of them made life for him just miserable and said, hey, go ahead and take your gal and run.
Where do you get that idea?
Over the years, I have read things like that about that defend him and say that he had this affair with this woman, and what we have been taught about him giving up his throne to run off and marry the woman that he loved has been a very overplayed thing.
Well, he did marry her, and they did stay together, and they seemed to be quite devoted to one another. So they really did. It wasn't just the gal that he was hot for. It was they really did have a strong relationship.
That's right.
And I don't think that that these people could have kept him from being a big influence as king if that's what he wanted to do. So I just think he was a little bit of a different kind of person. I haven't read about him, just to, you know, popular stuff.
Yeah.
So I would like to now find out, but boy, I've got such a list of things I want to find out more about that I don't know how I'll do that. But if anybody has anything about that, they can always write a comment into the
program. I'd like to hear from any of our audience about that particular thing and see what they feel about it.
Right.
So, well, I believe our time is up.
Yeah, well, it is up, but, you know, I have to edit this show, Ray, so we can spend a little bit more time here at the end.
Oh, okay.
You know, this business about Churchill is good, too. He makes it very clear what he thinks of Churchill. And also Rothermere, the big newspaper owner,
uh-huh.
newspaper man, was totally at the mercy of the Jews, because they were able to cut off the advertising for his paper. Or was the same way they put Henry Ford at their mercy. These stories need to be told to more and more people. Need to understand these things. And when he mentioned Baldwin, and that Stanley Baldwin, who was prime minister from 1935 to 1937, so he was one of these no good things, and also Neville Chamberlain. He doesn't think well of either one of those. They were they started it. He said Baldwin started the rot, and he had great interest in the arms industry. That's all.
Yeah.
And rearmament.
Made a ton of money off of it.
Right. And then he says Chamberlain was the same. I never thought of Chamberlain that way. But
no, I guess
Chamberlain was interested in money, too. Well, that's what he says anyway. Okay, well, that's all I have, Ray. Are you ready to sign off?
Well, okay, just one more sentence here. Back on what we were talking about, the Duke of Windsor, Hitler does say the Duke of Windsor had given that speech in Berlin, and he said it was his life's ambition to effect a reconciliation between Britain and Germany, talking about the rift in World War One, and he said what he did there was so positive, and then he says the subsequent treatment of the Duke of Windsor was an evil omen. So he was treated very badly, okay, by the British establishment. It was because of his reaching out to Germany, and that fits in with what the articles over the years that I have read about him being forced out because he wanted peace with Germany. So anyway, I'd like to hear from our
listeners. Well, maybe they were going to call him a traitor or something and end up doing like...
Yeah, the king could just go ahead and abdicate, you know, under political pressure. So,
well, maybe in order to prevent a scandal, a big scandal like that.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Right.
Certainly a possibility, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, okay, we have some more very interesting things for next week. So, ladies and gentlemen, do please come back again, and we'll say good night now. Good night, Ray.
Good night, Carolyn. We'll see you folks on April the 2nd.